This is VOA News. Via remote, I'm Tommy McNeil. The U.S. on Monday finally reached U.S. President Joe Biden's goal of getting at least one COVID-19 shot and to 70% of American adults. A month late and amid a fierce surge by the Delta variant that is swamping hospitals and leading to new mask rules and mandatory vaccinations around the country. In a major retreat in the Deep South, Louisiana ordered nearly everyone, vaccinated or not, to wear masks again in all indoor public settings, including schools and colleges. And other cities and states likewise moved to reinstate precautions to counter a crisis blamed on the fast-spreading variant and stubborn resistance to getting the vaccine. Germany will in September start to offer a booster shot against COVID-19 to vulnerable individuals like pensioners and people with weak immune systems. And that's according to the health ministers of the country's 16 states in a statement on Monday. The vaccinations will be done using the mRNA vaccinations from Pfizer, BioNTech, and Moderna, regardless of what was used previously. The ministers concluded after talks with federal health minister. They also agreed to make vaccinations available to all children ages 12 to 17. Those decisions reflect concerns in Germany that the Delta variant, first discovered in India and which spreads faster, could force the country back into restrictions and lockdowns as Europe's largest economy nears a general election in September. Germany's 16 states, which manage their own health affairs, are eager to vaccinate more people to avoid a fourth wave of the coronavirus. More at voanews.com. This is VOA News. The Biden administration on Monday expanded its efforts to assist at-risk Afghan citizens flee Taliban violence as fighting intensifies ahead of the U.S. military pullout at the end of the month. The U.S. State Department said it is widening the scope of Afghans eligible for refugee status in the United States to include current and former employees of U.S.-based news organizations, U.S.-based aid and development agencies, and other relief groups that receive U.S. funding. Current and former employees of the U.S. government and the NATO military operation who don't meet the criteria for a dedicated program for such workers are also covered. However, the move comes with a major caveat that may severely limit the number of people who can benefit. Applicants must leave Afghanistan to begin the adjudication process that may take 12 to 14 months in a third country, and the U.S. does not intend to support their departures or stays there. Iran's foreign ministry said Monday it will respond promptly to any threat against its security after the United States, Israel, and Britain blamed Tehran for an attack on an Israeli-managed tanker off the coast of Oman. Tehran has denied any involvement in the suspected drone attack Thursday, in which two crew members, a Briton and a Romanian, were killed. The United States and Britain said Sunday they would work with their allies to respond to the attack on the Mercer Street, a Liberian-flagged Japanese-owned petroleum product tanker managed by an Israeli-owned company. Britain summoned the Iranian ambassador on Monday. Later, Iran summoned the British charge and Romania's top envoy in Tehran over their country's accusations against the Islamic Republic, Iran's semi-official Fars news agency reported. The number of children traveling alone who were picked up at the U.S.-Mexican border by immigration authorities likely hit an all-time high in July, and the number of people who came in families likely reached its second highest total on record. That's according to a U.S. official on Monday. New Zealand's Prime Minister Jacinda Ardern issued on Sunday a somber state apology to the Pacific community for racially targeted immigration raids that took place in the 1970s and resulted in the deportation and prosecution of many. The so-called dawn raids, which often occurred early in the mornings, took place from 1974 to 1976. When New Zealand's economy was in a downturn and the government clamped down on immigrant workers from the Pacific overstaying their work visas. There is more at voanews.com. Via remote, I'm Tommy McNeil, VOA News.
Morning Africa, and welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm Jackson Vunganyi in Washington. Today is Tuesday, August 3rd, and here are some of the stories we're covering for you this morning. Tanzania's opposition are calling for protests after their leader is charged with terrorism. They say that President Suluhu Hassan has failed on her promises of reform.
They have stalled on the most important area of her predecessor's toxic legacy.
Tundu Lissu, Tanzania's opposition leader, currently in exile in Belgium. More with him later on the show. As Zambians prepare to hold elections, the Electoral Commission in the country has banned the main opposition United Party for National Development, UPND Alliance, for campaigning in its stronghold.
But we also want to state that the Electoral Commission of Zambia in elections is a referee and shouldn't be seen to be playing on the other side of the team.
Tabo Kawana, spokesperson for the UPND Alliance, and Cameroonian women have asked for an immediate end to hostilities and inclusive dialogue to stop a deepening separatist crisis in the country. We have those stories and more coming up right here on Daybreak Africa. And for our top story, Tanzania's main opposition party, Chadema, is calling on its supporters to hold protests over the arrest of its leader, Freeman Mbowe. Mr. Mbowe was scheduled to speak at a conference to announce demands for constitutional reforms. Government says that he was arrested for holding an illegal assembly. Anli said that the case of Mr. Mbowe, who now faces charges of terrorism, highlights fears among the Tanzanian opposition that the new president is not committed to the reforms that she had promised when she took office earlier this year. Former Tanzanian lawmaker and opposition leader Mr. Tundu Lissu, currently in exile in Belgium, tells me that President Hassan has not only failed to reverse the repressive policies of her predecessor, John Magufuli, she is continuing in what he calls Magufuli's toxic legacy of persecuting his opponents with trumped-up charges.
The new president, Samia Suluhu Hassan, started on a very positive note. The first 100 days were very hopeful. Tanzanians in and out of the country heaved a massive collective sigh of relief. She made some very encouraging statements about respecting people's rights, about not using the state machinery in the abusive ways of her predecessor. She even released a few prisoners who should never have been in prison in the first place.
So she started off well. How is she doing right now?
Over the past month, over the past week, 4 weeks or so, those first tentative steps have stalled, and they have stalled on the most important area of her predecessor's toxic legacy, the question of political rights, of political association. Tanzania is a multi-party state, but we have been suffering from 5 years or more of illegal political persecution. We're being prevented from carrying out lawful political activity since 2015. Our leaders up and down the country at all levels of the party have been persecuted very, very brutally. We have at least 400 Chadema members and leaders who are in various prisons in the country.
And this happened in the last couple of months?
No. This happened. These are the Magufuli prisoners.
Okay.
So we thought that since she was talking about reconciliation, we thought that the easiest step would have been to release the political prisoners, to cease the persecution of our members and leaders in courts of law. And she didn't do that. We thought that she was going to lift the illegal ban on political activity that was imposed by her predecessor, but she said clearly, flatly refused to lift it. We thought she was going to restart the constitution-making process, which she co-chaired 7 years ago, to give the country a democratic constitution that it deserves. And she flatly rejected. So we have been forced as a result to carry out the kind of only internal party meetings that are not regulated by law. And she said it very clearly that all that you can hope for under my administration is to carry out internal party meetings. Now, once we started talking about the constitution in those internal party meetings, then all hell broke loose.
What is the status of Mr. Mbowe and other opposition leaders currently in custody? And are you confident that they will receive justice under the current status quo?
Mr. Mbowe and all our members who are in prison will not get justice, they will not get fair trial. We have experience, not just of 5 years of Magufuli, we have experience of 30 years of multi-party Tanzania, where people, particularly opposition members and leaders, are handed these fabricated, these spurious criminal charges, sedition, money laundering, tax evasion, whatever. And the offenses are only intended to keep them in prison because they are not bailable, or to keep them busy in courts so that they don't do any political activity when those offenses are bailable.
That is Tanzanian opposition leader, Mr. Tundu Lissu. I reached him at his home in Belgium. The Electoral Commission of Zambia has banned the main opposition United Party for National Development, UPND Alliance, for campaigning in Kanyama constituency. That's its stronghold in the capital, Lusaka. This after two supporters of the ruling Patriotic Front, PF, were killed following clashes with partisans of the UPND Alliance. And so far, the police have arrested four suspects while investigations continue into circumstances that led to the clashes. Meanwhile, incumbent President Edgar Lungu has deployed the military in parts of Lusaka, including in the Kanyama constituency, to help the police maintain law and order and to prevent additional violence. But Tabo Kawana, spokesperson for the UPND Alliance, says that one of the two people killed was the member of his party. He also says that the deployment of the military clearly shows that the president lacks confidence in the ability of the police to maintain peace during election season. Anli said that the political situation is tense in Lusaka and other parts of the country due to what they anticipate to be one of the most competitive presidential elections in the country's history. Zambians go to the polls on August the 12th to choose a new president and parliament. Responding to the campaign ban imposed by the Electoral Commission, Tabo Kawana tells VOA's Peter Cloti, who's currently in Zambia, that the punitive action taken against his group is unfair. He says the move shows the bias of the Electoral Commission.
Firstly, we want to condemn violence in its all forms, and we want to state that the death of the two is regrettable. But we also want to state that the Electoral Commission of Zambia in elections is a referee and shouldn't be seen to be playing on the other side of the team to create a trout man in the team. But this is exactly what they are doing. They are playing as a trout man in the team on the side of PF, and they are working in cahoots with PF.
Why are you saying that the ECZ is working in, hand in hand with the government, or so to speak, the ruling party? Why? Why do you say that?
Because every action they have taken against us has firstly been instigated by the Patriotic Front. This was a call by the Patriotic Front that we should be banned in Kanyama, and the ECZ has gone ahead to ban us in Kanyama. The very ECZ had stated before that they are going to carry out an investigation, which we wondered how the ECZ can carry out an investigation in a murder case. Investigations in murder cases are vested in the hands of the police, and this incident is still under investigations, and the police have not yet concluded with their investigations to conclusively say that the two murdered people were murdered by UPND supporters. Secondly, the two who were killed are PF supporters, when in fact not. Actually, one of them is our own member, who was even a chairperson.
Some people are expressing concern that it appears that the UPND has been engaging in acts of violence, and in some instances, they argue, the UPND cadres or supporters have been unleashing violence or beating up supporters of the ruling party. How do you respond to such criticism?
It is not possible that we can instigate violence when we are looking for votes among the people. Now, the PF cadres have a tendency of going into our camps and creating havoc there. And particularly what happened in Kanyama is that the PF cadres went and broke into our camp, and our people were not there, and it is the Kanyama residents that descended upon them. And after defeating them, they went back and reinforced and came back with six busloads of cadres, and had a serious violent fight there, which resulted in the death of two people, one a PF cadre and another a UPND cadre. Therefore, it is important that we all give the police an opportunity to investigate and find out exactly what happened and who committed what. Therefore, this decision by the ECZ is not only premature, but it is clearly a premeditated decision designed to disadvantage us in this election. But suffice it to say that we are going to win these elections convincingly, and even Kanyama constituency itself is in our bag. We are going to win it convincingly. Even the action they have taken is too little too late, but we want to assure the residents of Kanyama that we will continue to engage them in a peaceful manner, as we have always done, and that we want to call upon the residents to desist from mob justice whenever they are provoked by the PF cadres, which is the norm.
That was Thabo Kawana, spokesperson for the UPND Alliance in Zambia. He was speaking to VOA's Peter Cloti, currently in Lusaka, Zambia. You're listening to Daybreak Africa on The Voice of America. I'm Jackson Vunganyi. Gambia's pro-democracy activists have suffered a major legal setback blow as the High Court in Banjul refuses to grant their request for the Gambian government and the country's election commission to be compelled to register Gambians living in the diaspora to vote in the upcoming elections scheduled for December 4th, 2021. The High Court has ruled that it's only the Supreme Court that can issue such an order to compel the government to extend franchise to diasporan Gambians. Pat Nderimbai reports from Raleigh, North Carolina.
The Supreme Court had earlier this year issued a ruling in favor of the Gambian activists by ruling that Gambians living overseas reserve the right to vote and be elected into public office. Though the court did not formally order the government to extend franchise to the diasporan community, the activists went to the High Court, asking the court to issue a declaration that would compel the Independent Electoral Commission, IEC, to register Gambians living overseas ahead of the elections. The court has dismissed their request while citing the lack of jurisdictional powers. Jagan Gray Johnson is one of the plaintiffs suing the government and the IEC.
The High Court judge stated today that the Supreme Court had the power to compel the IEC or make an order directing the IEC by way of mandamus, but instead granted a declaration of the rights already provided in the Constitution. Thus, the High Court, which is a lower court, could not therefore grant the same order as asked for by ourselves, the applicants, in the Supreme Court, but for which the Supreme Court did not grant.
The activists are not giving up. They are planning to file another lawsuit before the Supreme Court, this time asking the court to issue a declaration that would compel the IEC to register Gambians in the diaspora.
So as things stand now, we are looking at going back to pursue this matter through the courts, going back to the Supreme Court to basically ask them to at least again look at the enforcement mechanisms that are available.
The Electoral Commission has finished its voter registration exercise. Close to 1 million voters have been registered. Plaintiff Chornon Njai describes the court ruling as shocking.
For me and other plaintiffs, this is a very trying and in some sense a disappointing occasion. The fact that we are here, for me, indicates the larger failure of the transition of the coalition government. These are matters that should have been handled in year one after Jammeh left the Gambia.
The IEC says in order for the diaspora community to be registered, the constitution should be amended. But the activists disagree. Speaking at a Zoom press conference, Pasamba Jau, one of the plaintiffs, debunked the government's claims regarding the issue of budgetary expenses involved in funding such a voter registration drive.
Here's the thing. The issue about diaspora voting funding is nothing but a gimmick, and it demonstrates the dishonesty of this administration. It is very ironic that the current finance minister, who was one of Jammeh's henchmen, is now pretty much deciding whether you should vote or should not vote. The reality of the matter is this. There is nothing in that budget that would suggest that diaspora voting was not allocated for.
Gambians are going to the polls on December 4, 2021, to elect a post-transition president. Over 18 political parties have been registered to take part in the elections. For VOA Daybreak Africa, this is Pandering by reporting from Raleigh, North Carolina.
You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm Jackson Vunganyi. Let's go to East Africa in Uganda, where authorities have rescued dozens of young girls fleeing from female genital mutilation, known as FGM. At least 70 girls were rescued from eastern Uganda in the border districts with neighboring Kenya. Leaders say that the tradition, though outlawed, has remained in the society. Reporter Mugume Davis Rwakarinji has more from Kampala, Uganda.
Agnes Igoye, the Deputy National Coordinator for Prevention of Trafficking in Persons at Uganda's Minister of Internal Affairs, says the police is working with local leaders to ensure that the rescued girls are safe when they are returned to their communities.
We still have children, especially who have run away from home across the border, because you know that's a border community, you know, the Pokota, both in Ugandan side, but also in Kenya. So the 70 girls, we are talking about, you know, returning them. But, you know, you have to return them and make sure that what they ran away in the first place is dealt with. So the issue of female genital mutilation is a huge issue.
Female genital mutilation, FMG, includes the partial or total removal of the female external genitalia or other injury to the female genital organs for non-medical reasons. An estimated 3 million girls and women worldwide are at risk of facing FMG each year, according to World Health Organization, or WHO. The practice can have diverse effects on women, some of them fatal. These include fistula, severe bleeding, infections, infertility, and increased risk of childbirth complications, according to WHO. Proponents of the practice consider FMG as important for proper sexual behavior and sometimes prepare a girl or woman for adulthood and marriage. Chemasat Kisos is a legislator for Soi County of Queen District, one of the areas where the practice is still common. He says, unfortunately, the practice is still so deep-rooted in culture.
You know, the biggest challenge most of the time is that when they are circumcising the boys, the songs sensitize them so much because the songs are so emotive in nature, to an extent that they willingly end up joining again the exercise.
Yvonne Raruni, a program officer in charge of prevention of violence against children at local NGO, Raising Voices, disagrees. She says leaders should take a lead to sensitize the population against the practice.
By the time you have 70 girls running away to go to another place, it shows that that place is not safe. And so if this practice was okay, if it was good, like the custodians want us to believe, Why would these children be running away? If it was a practice that brought dignity, that was not harmful in any way, that was physically safe, emotionally safe, that did not hurt their dignity, they wouldn't have run away. But when we see children running away to go to another place, it means they do not find that place safe.
Uganda enacted anti-FMG law in 2010 to fight the vice. The law provides for tougher sentences, including life imprisonment and death penalty for culprits. For VOA News, I am Mugume, Davis Rwakarinji, Kampala, Uganda.
And we stay in East Africa, in Kenya, where the National Cancer Control Program is using the month of August to raise awareness about lung cancer, a deadly disease that kills the majority of people diagnosed with it. The program says that 729 people out of 794 diagnosed with lung cancer die each year in Kenya due to late diagnosis and poor treatment options available in the country. Reporter Maureen Ojambo has more.
August being the Lung Cancer Awareness Month, the disease claims many lives across the world, with only smaller percentage of those diagnosed with lung cancer surviving for 10 years and above. According to Dr. Catherine Nyongesa, a radiation oncologist from Kenya, many lung cancer patients perish because of misdiagnosis.
In Kenya, we see about 794 new cancer cases every year, that is of lung, and unfortunately 729 patients succumb to lung cancer every year. We suspect there's also underreporting of this lung cancer because many patients are treated for bronchitis, TB, pneumonia, or other chronic lung diseases, and the doctors sometimes are not aware that this could be cancer.
Ruth Wanjiko, a 24-year-old Kenyan lady, was diagnosed with lung cancer at the age of 19, a condition doctors said must have come as a result of previous radiations after surviving another cancer.
I didn't have lung cancer. It just came after I survived the cancer. It metastasized from the leg to the lung. Sometimes when it's cold, it's hard for me to move because I had pneumothorax on my left lung now, and it has not been easy for me, although it was removed early June. And like now, if I tell you the truth, I have cancer on my left lung, the only lung I'm remaining with.
Ruth, who has been working as a taxi driver, has now stopped working due to increased cases of COVID-19 in Kenya.
I'm an online taxi driver. So, you know, with this COVID-19, it's not easy because you don't know the person you're meeting. He just stay indoors at times, although I have to be extra careful. I get severe pain like all the time, my dear. Like, no, I'm not even working because I'm vomiting. A lot happens in life whenever you have cancer. All I can tell you is be happy when you can.
According to Kenya's National Cancer Control Program, most lung cancer cases were recorded in people between the ages of 50 to 79 years and was attributed to slow disease progression and delays in early diagnosis. Dr. Nyongesa says exposure to smoking increases the risk of the disease.
Your risk of lung cancer increases with the number of cigarettes you smoke each day and the number of years you've smoked. Other risk factors include previous radiation therapy, exposure to asbestos, family history of lung cancer, and more important, aging. We see most of the lung cancer is in older people.
Dr. Nyongesa says creating awareness for lung cancer in Kenya will help reduce deaths.
We also don't have very good national cancer registry. It's still in development, and we suspect that many patients are not actually being reported when they have lung cancer. 10% of all the lung cancer patients, after treatment, they are able to survive for 10 years or more after the diagnosis.
According to the World Health Organization, lung cancer claimed many lives in the year 2020. The lung cancer incidence rates have been higher among men than women because men started smoking in large numbers and smoked at higher rates. Reporting for VOA's Daybreak Africa, I am Maureen Ojambo in Milwaukee, USA.
And that's it for this Tuesday, August the 3rd edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for spending this morning with us. Join us again tomorrow for more African news and features right here on the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty, I'm Jackson Vunganyi in Washington, wishing you a